You're listening to Bible Truth Feed, a podcast by Christadelphianvideo.org for Christadelphians and all those seeking the truth about the Bible message. Join us now as we present our latest episode.
Now we come to celebrate around the true Lamb of God that has taken away the sin of the world this morning, even our Lord Jesus Christ. And our readings, brothers and sisters, from Tuesday and for the next few weeks are all about the restoration of the people of God from their captivity in Babylon, as seen in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And it's really a period of high drama. It's full of ups and downs, tragedy and triumph. It was really an exciting time where the enthusiasm of God's people soars and then it wanes and then it soars again. They faced incredible challenges, difficult times, but they come through. Why? Because of inspiring, faithful leadership. Spiritual men and women who stood up to the task when it counted. Men like Joshua, Zerubbabel, Haggai, Zechariah, Mordecai. Women like Esther and Nehemiah and Malachi. Men and women of passion and zeal who put their heart and soul into the work of the truth. But of all those faithful characters, brothers and sisters, there's no question that the father figure of that period was Ezra the scribe, the great Bible expositor. He was held in the highest regard by Jew and Gentile alike, and was recognized as the second, and still to this day, as the second only to Moses by the Jews. His name means a helper, and boy did he help. He's an inspiring example of how to help one's brothers and sisters. Because we need helpers in the ecclesia, don't we? They're indispensable, especially in this age of apathy and indifference, where the catchphrase of the moment is meh or whatever. You try and find solid, committed helpers today, committed ecclesial members who are motivated, full of enthusiasm. It can sometimes be hard to find dedication on that level. We all give all sorts of excuses, you know, it's too hard, or it's not worth it, or why bother, or we've tried that. You know, one of the big lessons from this period, brothers and sisters, is that apathy and indifference kills ecclesial life. And if you remember nothing else from this morning, let it be to go forward from this point on determined to be a helper like Ezra. He got involved and led by example, rubbing up shoulder to shoulder with his brothers and sisters. But of course we know that he is but a type. Because we are here this morning to remember the greatest helpers of all time. The Father and the Son, who worked together to help you and to help me. And the dedication and commitment that they gave to help us is nothing short of astronomical. And the sheer relief that their help has given us is the very reason why we are here this morning. Well, the book of Ezra, brothers and sisters, is really neatly divided into two halves. Chapter 1 to 6 covers the first return under Joshua and Zerubbabel, and they came back to rebuild the temple of God. Whereas chapter 7 to 10 is the second return under Ezra, and he's coming back, brothers and sisters, to build the people of God. In fact, the subdivisions of the two halves are identical. Go home and have a look at that. They are identical. And the reason for that is because Ezra wants us to know that the real temple is made up of people. And he's coming back to put life into those stones that have just been built. So the decree goes out for anyone who wanted to return here in Ezra chapter 1. There's no excuse, there's every reason to return. Yet of the hundreds and thousands that were taken into captivity, Only 42,360 returned, plus another 7,000 or so servants. Most chose to stay in Babylon, in their 3- and 4-story high houses that archaeologists have discovered there, where there was good job security, all the latest gadgets, the best universities for the kids. They even have discovered running water in the kitchen. Who'd want to come back to burnt out ruins and live in tents? But back they came with fervor and determination. And we pick up the record in Ezra chapter 3, brothers and sisters, and verse 1, where it says, "And when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man." They were united, brothers and sisters, and great things happen when we're united. I want you to remember that phrase. Just tuck it away. As one man. And what were they able to do? Well, verse 3 tells us that they built the altar of God. That's the first thing they did. I don't know about you, but I think I'd probably be more interested in building a wall and protecting myself. Not them. They had their priorities right. They put God first. Then over in verse 8, the next thing they did was to build the foundation of the house of God. The new temple had begun. An exciting time. It's a reason to celebrate. And down in verse 11, they were singing and praising God. It was a happy, joyous occasion. You'll see there in verse 11, they sang together by chorus in praising and giving thanks unto Yahweh because he is good. It was a happy occasion, or it should have been. Because on this day, brothers and sisters, there were actually two groups of people. And you'll see them in verse 12. There was one group, the old ancient men, but many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers who were ancient men that had seen the first house. When the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, they wept with a loud voice. It's not as good as the previous temple, they said. These are those who are always living in the past. They were dwelling on all the negatives of why the project shouldn't continue. But the verse ends, "And many shouted aloud for joy." Clearly, this is the young people who'd never seen anything like this before. They'd never seen the first temple. This was new and exciting, and they were excited and they were enthusiastic. Well, what happened? Well, verse 13 says, "So that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off." If you were to stand some distance away from this scene, you wouldn't have been able to tell if they were laughing or crying. That's the result of that day. And the end result, due to the division between the young and the old, there in chapter 3, and because of all the enemies without, mentioned in chapter 4, we come across to chapter 4, verse 24. The end result is that the work ceased. It stopped. It was stopped in its tracks. The old people won the day, and they felt justified in doing so. But the young felt disappointed. They were disillusioned because of a lack of leadership. And so they left the building site and went and built their own houses with their plush carpets and their new fridges, while weeds grew up on the temple foundation. You know, brothers and sisters, one of the worst feelings in the world is having your youthful enthusiasm crushed. Yes, young people may say some dumb things or do even dumber things, but don't crush that positive spirit. It's up to you who are older to harness it instead and help them to channel that zeal in the right areas, because they are your ecclesia's future. And I'm speaking now to some who are around my age, that my greatest fear, one of my biggest fears, is to grow old and grumpy. and be one of those who harp on about the good old days, the golden years. But brothers and sisters, there's no such thing. The temple of God are the people living in your ecclesia today, both old and young. You know, there's nothing worse than going to an ecclesial business meeting when a new work project gets suggested. And the sayings get said, oh, we can't afford that, it's too expensive, or it's too much effort, I don't have the time, and it gets canned. And then everybody goes home to their expensive cars and caravans and holidays and swimming pools and even talking fridges. I know, I install them, so they do exist. And so 15 or 16 years go by. Sadly, a generation slips by. So what does God do? Well, he sends two prophets in chapter 5. Two? Why? Well, I believe, brothers and sisters, it was because one was an old prophet and the other was a young prophet. And God's appealing to both groups. You'll see that in chapter 5, verse 1. Then the prophets Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of God, of the God of Israel, even unto them. Haggai, I believe he was an old man, because in his book, in his prophetical account, he counts himself as among those who can remember God's house in its former glory. You'd have to be at least 70 years or more to do that, and to be able to still remember it. And he comes on the scene and he says, consider your ways, he says, which is a phrase which means to set your heart on your past experiences. And Haggai's got some experience, you see. Whereas Zechariah, he comes on the scene bursting with energy. He receives 7 visions all in one night. And he remembers every single one of them. I would barely remember one, but his youthfulness allows him to absorb them all, and he races out onto the temple site to thrill the workers with apocalyptic visions. He's brimming with enthusiasm as he explains them. And so God sent these two prophets to rouse the people up. Now you'll note in verse 2 that they don't just talk about it either, pointing from the sidelines like couch-sitting supervisors. They actually got in and helped. Verse 2, then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. And with them were the prophets of God helping them. They got in and helped. And in 4 years, the house was finished with the indispensable help of Zerubbabel, Joshua, Haggai, and Zechariah. You know, it's foolish, brothers and sisters, to talk that we don't need leaders, that the ecclesia can just decide for itself. Not so. When people are inspired, that's when they'll work. And so up went the temple in no time. Chapter 6, verse 15 says, and the house was finished on the third day of the month Adar. It's completed. So now we come in chapter 7 to Ezra and the second return that he led with a burning ambition to help educate the people of God around this new temple. And really, I don't think a greater testimony can be given to his character than here in chapter 7. We note in verse 1 to verse 5 his genealogy, and we find out that he's actually a priest. A priest down through the line of Hilkiah, down through the line of Phinehas, back to Aaron. He's a priest, first of all. A priest was commanded by God to teach his people, Deuteronomy 24, verse 8. But if you want to be a good, solid teacher, you need to know your Bible. So in verse 6, not only was he a priest, he was also a ready scribe in the law of Moses. See that in verse 6. This Ezra went up from Babylon, and he was a ready scribe in the law of Moses. And a scribe's job was to write out the Bible. He got familiar with all the phrases and all the principles that God had recorded through the writings of Moses. He marked his Bible. He was well versed in Scripture. In fact, this word ready there in verse 6, the Hebrew word maher, it really means to be quick. And when you're quick at something, it's because you're good at it. All right? When you employ somebody, you find out how quick they are. And if they're not very quick, out the door. You want someone that's skillful. That's really the word here. Someone that is skillful. It's from a root word which means to be liquid. And so it's able to flow quite easily. Here's Ezra, brothers and sisters. He's a skillful scribe. The scriptures just flowed out of him. This word only occurs three other times. I'm not going to turn all of these up. You may want to jot them down. Isaiah 16, verse 5, a prophecy about Christ sitting on David's throne, skillful in righteousness, says Isaiah. Psalm 45, verse 1, my tongue is the pen of a ready writer. The writer, David, in that psalm says, the words just flow out of my mouth, off my tongue. Scripture just flowed out of him. But this one I do want you to turn up in Proverbs. Proverbs 22. Just come over to these words because I think it's quite apt for Ezra. Really sums up this man. Proverbs 22, verse 29. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? That's our word, diligent. Okay? Skillful, yes, but diligent. Seest thou a man diligent in his business? And he was. Ezra was very diligent as a scribe. He didn't just do the readings in 5 minutes. He took time to spend. He was diligent in his understanding. What does it say about him in Proverbs 22, verse 29? Seest thou a man diligent in his business? He shall stand before kings. And here's Ezra, brothers and sisters, back in Ezra chapter 7, standing before the king Artaxerxes. Because you see, Ezra had a request. Ezra presented his request to King Artaxerxes, and the king trusted Ezra so much that he granted Ezra his request. Such was this man. We get a bit more about Ezra's character in verse 10, because verse 10 continues describing his wonderful attributes. It says, for Ezra had prepared his heart. You know, you can't do anything unless the heart is set right first. He didn't wait until a crisis and say, well, I better start doing something now. I think I should begin. No. Years before, he purposefully prepared his heart. What for? Well, the verse continues, to seek the law of Yahweh. This word seek, the word means to follow or to tread frequently. It's not the same as the word in chapter 8, verse 22. It's a different word. Jesenius says it means to inquire. And Rotherham's translates it as that he settled his heart to study the law of Yahweh. So what's this telling us about Ezra? It's saying that he frequently inquired from the law of Yahweh. There was a well-trodden path to his desk. You could see the carpet was worn. Every time he went there, he was wearing down a path to sit down at his desk and pore over God's law. He was searching them out to see what he should do, because the verse continues by saying, not only did he prepare his heart to seek the law of Yahweh, when he found out what he was to do, he went and did it. And to do it, it says. Because when he learnt something, he then did it. He wasn't a hypocrite. He didn't say one thing and then do another. He practiced what he preached. And then he didn't just hold it to himself. He didn't just sit in a cave and say, well, I'm good. He then went and taught it to others and to teach in Israel statutes and judgments. He then went and helped others to understand the Bible too, because he was a helper. A remarkable individual. A wonderful Bible student. And so, of course, the king granted Ezra all his request. And in fact, the rest of chapter 7 is really about Artaxerxes writing a letter of recommendation. And it's the most amazing letter. You read that letter, it's staggering. The amount of respect that the king and his seven counselors, which we assume was probably his cabinet, the head of government, all the respect they had for Ezra is palpable. Look at what he wrote in this letter. Down in verse 15, he gives him a command to carry the silver and gold which the king and his counselors have freely given. So out of his personal wealth, the king gave to Ezra silver and gold. He loaded him up with riches beyond measure and said, here, use this, take this down with you. In verse 20, and whatsoever more shall be needful for the house of thy God, which thou shalt have occasion to bestow, bestow it out of the king's treasure house. And I, even I, Artaxerxes the king, do make a decree to all the treasurers which are on the other side of the river, that whatsoever Ezra the priest, the scribe of the law of God of heaven, shall require of you, it be done speedily. If you need more, Ezra, then I command my local treasurers to supply your request with speed. Ezra, if you use up all this money that I've already given you here, just pop into the local branch down there in Jerusalem and they'll fix it up for you, whatever you need. He gave him a blank check. Oh, and by the way, Artaxerxes says in verse 24, you and all your helpers in this work, the priests, singers, porters, Levites, etc., are all exempt from taxation. You can live tax-free. And then to top it all off, in verse 25 and 26, brothers and sisters, he gave permission to Ezra that if anyone refused to fulfill this command that he'd written, then you can banish them, you can confiscate their goods, you can imprison them, you can even kill them. He gave Ezra the power of life and death. You know, if Ezra, brothers and sisters, was anything less of a man that we've come to find out, if he had an ounce of corruption in him, look what he could have done. If this wasn't a blaring endorsement of Ezra's character, then I don't know what is. Could your boss at work write a letter of recommendation like that about you? He's a towering example, isn't he, of diligence and commitment to the things of God. Well, in chapter 8, they set out for Jerusalem. And in verse 15, it says that they gathered together at a meeting place just outside of Babylon at a place called Ahava, by a river there. And there they stayed, it says, there abode we in tents for 3 days. Why? Why park up there for 3 days? I thought the work needed to be done. Go down to Jerusalem and begin. Well, this was the meeting place. Ezra hasn't had a chance to just see everyone that said, yes, we're going to go. And he knows why he's going to Jerusalem. He wants to build the people of God. And he knows that you cannot build a spiritual house without spiritual teachers. So he runs from tent to tent, viewing the people who had come. It says, I viewed the people. What's he looking for as he's going from tent to tent? He's looking, brothers and sisters, for Bible students, for teaching priests like himself. Ezra's return was all about education. He knew it was pointless continuing unless he had good, solid Bible teachers. So he went hunting for Levites, who were Bible students. And it says in verse 15, and found there none of the sons of Levi. He didn't find one. So he said, let's stop. It's useless to proceed. I need to find some Levites before we go on. Because you know about the Levites, how they had been spread throughout Israel in those 48 cities. They were the recognized teachers of the nation. But you see, they didn't have an inheritance. They weren't allowed to own land. Yahweh was to be their inheritance. But here in Babylon, they had houses and land. They could do that and live it up. Why would you leave such a cozy life? But Ezra knows he needs some Levites. His journey would be a failure if he didn't have any. So we find out in verse 18 and 19 that eventually he's able to muster up 38 Levites. 38 Bible students. Reckon we could find 38 Bible students in your ecclesia? Or in my ecclesia, brothers and sisters? Or even in Adelaide? Or is life today just really too cozy to get your head stuck in the Bible? I'm not talking about Bible readers. We all read the Bible. I'm talking about serious Bible students. You know, the one that if you had a question on the scriptures that stumped you, you could go to them and they'd have an answer because they've already studied that for themselves. He found 38. And in verse 24 to verse 30, he gave them a special job to do because they were going to be traveling for 4 months. And over that period of 4 months, he gave them a special job to do because the job would be preparing them for their work when they got down there. He put them in charge of all the holy vessels of gold and silver. How would that help them, being in charge of silver and gold? I thought Levites were teachers. Well, you see, first of all, you'll see in verse 26, I weighed all the silver and gold. He weighed all the vessels in front of these Levites. It was about, in today's language, about 30 tons. If you had half a ton per wagon, that's some 60 wagons to look after, full of silver and gold. And he was too embarrassed to ask the king for a bodyguard as well. All this gold's going down there, and he's got Levites in charge of it. So in verse 28, he says unto them, after weighing it in front of them, he says, ye are holy unto Yahweh, the vessels are holy also. The vessels, he's saying, are like you. In verse 29, watch ye and keep them. Because when we get to Jerusalem, I want you to weigh every single one of them again. And you say, well, why do that? Why weigh them again? Why not just count them up? Surely the weight would stay the same. Surely that would be enough. No, you make sure that not one vessel loses anything over that four-month journey. And it's quite obvious, I believe, to the Levites what Ezra was saying to them. He's telling them the vessels clearly represent people. You're Levites and you're holy. These vessels, these people, they're holy too. They're coming out of Babylon with the right spirit and the right motive. Your job is to make sure they don't lose any of that spirit of holiness by the time they get to Babylon. Do you know when Israel left Egypt, brothers and sisters, within 3 months, they were already complaining? I don't want a repeat of that, says Ezra, no matter how difficult the journey is. Ezra was so proactive. He's very astute. He's a very wise leader. But in chapter 9, we discover, brothers and sisters, it wasn't a pleasant arrival when they got there. Things were worse, much worse than he even expected. And it broke his heart. And we read in verse 1, now when these things were done, the princes came to me saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the lands. They've mixed in with all of those around. They've started to have children with those around. They're marrying foreign wives. They're starting to worship their gods. The children can't even speak Hebrew. The truth's been watered down. Boundary lines that they once observed to help keep them separate were now being fudged and crossed over. And the worst thing was, they didn't even know how bad they really were. And in verse 3, poor Ezra, he sits down astonished. And when I heard this, he says, I rent my garment and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head and off my beard and sat down astonished. Tore open his shirt, ripped apart his mantle, pulling clumps of hair out of his head and his beard, and he sinks to the floor with tears running down his face. He's absolutely distraught when he saw the reality of the situation, and he knew right there and then that a reformation was needed. And so he prayed in verse 5, brothers and sisters, and I mean he really prayed. Because in verse 6, the first thing he does in his prayer is that he identifies himself with his people. Now you think of that. For Ezra, it was never, oh, us and them. It was always we together. I am ashamed, he says, and I blush, he says in verse 6 to God, to lift up my face to thee, my God. For our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespass is growing up unto the heavens. And to really paraphrase his prayer, brothers and sisters, without reading every verse there, which is such a powerful prayer, he continues by saying that we've sinned before you. And that's really why we went into captivity in the first place. That's why we went up into Babylon. You sent us there to teach us a lesson. And yet now, in verse 8, you've given us a little space, just a little breathing space by your grace. You've let us out. You've extended mercy to us. You've set us free. And we've gone and done the same thing again, he says. It was a heartfelt and moving prayer. And he's sobbing his eyes out. You read that in chapter 10, verse 1. Now when Ezra had prayed and when he had confessed, weeping and casting himself down before the house of God, he's pouring his eyes out. While this prayer's going on, word got around. And slowly people started to hear about this man sitting down, praying out loud about all their sins and asking for God's help. And all the congregation slowly crept in to hear this godly man pray his heart out. Because the place where Ezra was praying was right in front of the temple. You'll see that in verse 1, before the house of God. In fact, in verse 9, it says halfway through, and all the people sat in the street of the house of God. It's called a street. It really was a big open square, like a public forum. And everybody was able to gather inside this public forum. And they all crept in. And they've got tears streaming down their faces too. Verse 1 at the end says, for the people wept very sore. Everybody's crying. And in verse 9, at the end of verse 9, it says that even heaven started to weep. They all sat in the street of the house of God, trembling because of this matter and for the great rain. So they're all sitting out there in the pouring rain. Ezra's prayer, brothers and sisters, caused such remorse that when he stopped praying, he never said another word. There was silence, and everybody in that big square started awkwardly shifting around. And suddenly a voice cries out from the crowd in verse 2, a man by the name of Shechaniah. He calls out in verse 2 to down verse 4. He says, Ezra, we have sinned. You're right. You're absolutely right. And we want to change. We do want to change. But we don't know how. In verse 4, he says, we need your help. Please help us. Because this matter belongs unto thee. We will also be with thee. Be of good courage and do it. And in verse 5, brothers and sisters, Ezra got to his feet. And he said to them, do you mean that? Like, do you really mean that? And they swore. They said, yes, we do. We need your help. Well, right. This is what has to happen. It's amazing. He had such an enormous reputation that the people responded to him and a reformation was made. And you can go through and count in chapter 10. 113 men are named as having separated from their foreign wives. Things got back on track because of this man. Well, Ezra appears to have returned back to Persia, brothers and sisters, and Nehemiah comes down, and of course, he built the wall again in a record time of 52 days. And now comes the time to dedicate the new wall. The new wall's finished. Come to Nehemiah chapter 8, brothers and sisters, where we pick up the life of Ezra again. What would you do to celebrate? Well, in Nehemiah chapter 8, brothers and sisters, it's a remarkable chapter. It takes place only 5 days after the wall is finished. And in fact, in this chapter, there are three reasons to celebrate. Number one, of course, the wall is built in record time. Number two is that it was the first day of the seventh month. And if you know your Jewish calendar and feasts, the seventh month was crammed of many feasts. And it was sort of like a climax of all the feasts coming together in the seventh month, a reason to be thankful. And number three, Ezra's back in town. And we read in chapter 8 and verse 1, and all the people gathered themselves together as one man. What a phrase. Remember that from chapter 3 of Ezra? See what's possible when you're united? Back then, it was the altar and the temple foundations. Here, it's the complete city walls, all finished. And where are they? And all the people gathered themselves together as one man into the street. Oh, what a place, the big open square in front of the temple, where years ago they were brought to tears by Ezra. Well, they're not crying here. This is a celebration. And who do they ask to help in this celebration? Well, it says in verse 1 that they came together as one man into the street that was before the water gate, and they spake unto Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses. They spake. It's not just Nehemiah and his advisors. I'm sure they were involved. It's all the people. They requested that Ezra speak to them. Well, of course. Who else would you choose? He was the recognized Bible expositor. You know, when good Bible students stand up to speak, brothers and sisters, you get inspired by that. I know you do. You get motivated by that. You get electrified by that. And when you have enough electricity buzzing in your ecclesia, then everybody can shine like beacons. When my home ecclesia, Enfield, had its hall built, I don't know, some 60-odd years ago, who did they ask to do their opening special effort? Why, it was Uncle Perce Mansfield. I mean, who else? But there's not many brothers and sisters that can do that can stand up and inspire like that. And even some of them are now no longer here. And I mentioned Uncle John, and now he's not here. Other Bible students that have been well liked and renowned, Uncle Jim Luke, Uncle Andrew Johns, Uncle Bruce Gerd. I remember, particularly as a young person, I remember doing anything to make sure I got to listen in on their talks. In fact, I remember once Uncle John Martin saying that for him, and he was speaking on this chapter actually, for him it was listening to Brother John Carter that just inspired him, and actually said if Brother John Carter was speaking, he'd make sure he'd be there even if he had leprosy. I think he might have smelt a bit and had to sit in the corner by himself, but he wouldn't have cared. To him, Brother John Carter was an exceptional Bible student, and he lapped up every word. Well, what did Ezra do in verse 2? Well, Ezra the priest, brought the law before the congregation, both of men and women, and all that could hear with understanding. In other words, Ezra got all the children minded. He got people there that could understand. So he got all the children minded. He wanted no distractions. He wanted everyone to understand the message he was about to expound to them. That's Ezra, a true teacher, a marvelous educator. His ambition had always been to help others understand the Bible. In fact, you could probably put at the top of this chapter as its heading, titling it, A Chapter of Understanding. You see in verse 3 as well, at the end of verse 3, and the ears of all the people were attentive unto the book of the law. In verse 7 it says that the Levites caused the people to understand the law. At the end of verse 8, they read in the book of the law of God distinctly and gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading. Down in verse 12, at the end of the verse, because they had understood the words that were declared unto them. At the end of verse 13, they came to Ezra the scribe even to understand the words of the law. It's a chapter of understanding. Yes, it's a celebration, but the focus is on understanding the Bible. And he read in verse 3, from morning to midday. And I'm looking at the clock and it's coming up to midday, or just past midday now. But he'd been starting since light, 4 hours minimum. And it says all the people's ears stayed attentive. Imagine that in today's world where attention spans can't even stretch beyond 15 minutes sometimes. They stood attentive, their ears pinned back, listening to every word. And in verse 5, it says, and Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people. So not only their ears, but their eyes were fastened on him. They were locked in. And they had so much respect for Ezra that it says in verse 5, for he was above all the people. And when he opened it, all the people stood up. It was a spontaneous reaction. It was like Ezra and the scroll that he was unrolling were one, like as if they were witnessing a living Bible standing there. The two things, Ezra the man and the scroll he was unrolling, could not be separated. And then what he did, I think, was a really marvelous thing in verse 7 and verse 8. Because what he did is he got a group of Levites to help him. He said, it's too big a crowd. I can't speak to this whole audience on my own. They won't hear every single word. He got a group of Levites together. And he said to these Levites, I want you to help me to get the people to understand the law. And you'll see at the end of verse 7, and the Levites caused the people to understand the law, and the people stood in their place. So the people stayed still, and all these Levites went in amongst the people and found little groups of people around them. And he divides them up and spreads them out amongst the people. And then in verse 8, it says, so they read in the book in the law of God. So it wasn't just Ezra. Ezra and the Levites, they read in the law of God distinctly. A word which means to separate, to break small into manageable pieces. And gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading. Now that's a bad translation. The word reading there is not as we would understand it. It's actually the Hebrew word mikra. It means a congregation or an assembly. It's from the Hebrew korah, to call out, which is the Old Testament word for ecclesia. He got everyone to understand in the ecclesia. And I think the way that he did it was probably that Ezra spoke a bit and then he stopped. And then the Levites would speak to those around him. Did you get that? Did you understand that? Did it make sense to you? Well, what he was saying was this, and they would break it down small and make sure everybody in their little group understood. And Ezra would wait. And then he'd ask if it was understood by everyone. And only when the Levites nodded their heads and said, yes, yes, you can go on, that he would then move on. He was a brilliant teacher of the word. And we know that they all understood, because they all started to weep in verse 9 at the realization of what the words of Ezra said meant to them. They started to mourn. And Nehemiah and Ezra go in and say, no, 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 it's not a day to cry. There will be those days, but this isn't one of them. You don't need to mourn today. And they encourage the people to celebrate and to go out of their way to include others less fortunate than themselves to share in this celebration. In verse 10, then he said unto them, go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, and send portions unto them for whom nothing is prepared. Look out for your brothers and sisters. For this day is holy unto our Lord. Neither be sorry, for the joy of Yahweh is your strength. The joy of Yahweh is where you'll find your greatest strength. And that's absolutely true, brothers and sisters. Where there's joy for the things of the truth in an ecclesia, there's strength in that ecclesia. And they were joyous. They were so joyous because down in verse 12 it says, they had all the people went their way to eat and to drink and to send portions and to make great mirth. Why? Because they had understood the words that were declared unto them. They were joyful because they understood the Bible. Isn't that a wonderful, wonderful lesson for us to take on board? Well, we can't really finish the life of Ezra without just looking at one last scene, the final scene in chapter 12, brothers and sisters. I love this little scene here, just to close and to bring our minds to the one who's greater than Ezra. It was a joyous occasion back then, and it continued with a march around the city walls, the dedication of the wall. And in verse 27, we read, "And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites." What for? Well, to form two choirs. You'll see in verse 31, "Then I brought up the princes of Judah upon the wall and appointed two great," it really should be, "choirs." Imagine that, Peter, two great choirs. We all loved last night, as I've said, and thought it was great. But this is a celebration, brothers and sisters, that's something else back then. And in verse 36, it says, "And his brethren, Shemaiah and Azrael," all of those names there, "with the musicians, the musical instruments of David, the man of God, and Ezra the scribe before them." So Nehemiah put Ezra in front of this great choir, the first one. And he started them marching off, and he said, "You go that way." And Ezra's out the front leading that choir. And in verse 38, the other choir, he sends in the other direction, and it says, "And the other company of them that gave thanks went over against them, and I after them." He goes in the back, does Nehemiah. He follows behind. And so what you have is these two great choirs marching around the walls of Jerusalem. Ezra's in the front of this one. And as they come around and they meet here, Ezra's in the middle of these two great choirs. And they're singing their hearts out, brothers and sisters. And Ezra's right there. And they're just above the house of God, probably just above that huge square. What a place. And I don't know exactly what happened next, but I like to imagine that Ezra somehow went down the steps and all the people saw him as he entered into that house of God, and he goes out of the record in a blaze of glory. And it says in verse 43, "Also that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoice, for God had made them rejoice with great joy. The wives also and the children rejoiced, so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard even afar off." This time, it's not a case of half laughing and half crying, is it? Like in Ezra chapter 3. Everyone's rejoicing, men, women, children, old and young together. Why? Because a man had prepared his heart many years ago and applied himself to seek and to do, and to teach, and to be a helper in his ecclesia. And so now we come, brothers and sisters, to celebrate the greatest helper who has ever lived. And do you know what? He plans to have a celebration too, in Jerusalem, in front of a new temple. And when he comes out of that temple in the future, brothers and sisters, I can tell you there's going to be a shout like you've never heard before. There's going to be singing too, even better than last night. And the joy of Jerusalem is going to be heard all around the world. What a time's coming, brothers and sisters. And you and I, along with Joshua, Zerubbabel, Haggai, Zechariah, Nehemiah, and the great man Ezra, will be able, by God's good grace, to share in that wonderful occasion too. May it indeed soon come. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you found the episode helpful. Don't forget, most of these episodes are also available as videos on our video channel, cdvideo.org. So head over and take a look. If you have any comments or questions or suggestions, please get in touch or leave us a voice message. We love to hear your feedback. You can email us at btf@cdvideo.org. If you enjoyed the episode, then please share it with others. Until next time, may God bless you in your studies and your walk towards God's kingdom. Amen.